This is the Sports Illustrated Boxing Podcast.
It's boxing.
A look inside boxing with Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix. Interviews, analysis, and everything going on in boxing. And now a man who I wish was called the Boston Bleeder.
All doctors to the ER.
It's sort of like getting punched in the face.
Chris Mannix.
All right, Keith Idek is in. BoxingScene.com. You can follow Keith on Twitter, at Idek Boxing. Subscribe to the podcast while you're listening. Subscribe, rate, review. Best way to make sure we keep doing this podcast week after week. Keith, what's happening, man?
Hey, Chris, how you doing?
I'm doing good. I feel like in the interest of full disclosure, we should tell people that once again, we experienced technical difficulties recording the first version. And I think this cements the fact that we should never try to record things on our own ever again.
That's probably correct. At least we didn't do 45 minutes this time, you know?
Yes, yes. At least we cut it off early after the first topic and try it now through our SI studios. So, all right, let's jump right back into where you and I left off, Keith, and that's the Sergey Kovalev, Canelo Alvarez situation, let's call it. Let's begin with last weekend, where Sergey Kovalev goes back to his hometown of Russia, defends his version of the 175-pound title, gets a knockout win over Anthony Yard, a fight that was not without its challenges. The eighth round was extremely tough for Sergey Kovalev. Buddy McGirt, his trainer, after that eighth round, threatened to stop the fight if Kovalev continued down that path, but he rallies, gets an 11th round knockout win. What did you think of Kovalev's performance in that fight?
It was a bit of an uneven performance, obviously, Chris, because while he did win the fight, as you mentioned, he almost got knocked out in the eighth round and almost cost himself an eight-figure payday in the process. So I was impressed with the way Kovalev came back from really severe trouble toward the end of the eighth there, because it did look like he was on. If Anthony Yard had another 10 or 15 seconds, he might have stopped Kovalev there and he'd be the WBO light heavyweight champion. But I was impressed with Kovalev's ability to come back at the very start of the ninth round, regain control of the fight, and then he pretty much put it on Anthony Yard for the next, you know, 2.5 rounds or so until the fight was stopped. Some of that was attributed, of course, to Yard's lack of conditioning. He was exhausted and could barely even stand up toward the end of the fight. So some of that is on him as well. But I was impressed with Kovalev's ability to come back, especially with so much at stake for him moving forward with the Canelo Alvarez fight. I think, you know, that's attributable to some degree to his conditioning. I mean, he's in very good shape. He's got a new training team, Teddy Cruz and Buddy McGirt. They did great work with Arturo Gatti back in the day. And Teddy's a great strength and conditioning guy. He's gotten Sergey Kovalev to listen more in training camp to his body and not overtrain. And so I think he had more left in the tank than he might have in previous years, even when he was a younger fighter and was able to come back from this. So I think his trainer and his strength and conditioning coach, Buddy McGirt and Teddy Cruz, deserve some credit here as well. And also, Chris, I think really what Buddy McGirt said to him in the corner was, you know, that was invaluable in a sense, because he told Sergey Kovalev, I'm not going to let you continue taking this kind of punishment. I'll stop this fight. And of course, unfortunately, Buddy McGirt was in the corner of Maxim Dadashev in early July, and he passed away from his brain damage that he suffered in that fight. So, you know, that was fresh on Buddy's mind and on his heart as well. So I think he was serious about that, and I think he imparted that to Sergey Kovalev in a way that let him know that he meant what he said. I think Kovalev took that to heart to some degree, and he was friends with Dadashev also. But he saw that Yard was very tired, and he told Buddy McGirt, don't stop the fight. I know he's tired. But then he was able internally to flip the switch and go out there and take it to Yard, make sure he didn't give Buddy McGirt the opportunity to stop the fight, and of course got himself now into position to fight Canelo Alvarez.
Yeah, kind of a chilling moment after that eighth round, knowing what Buddy McGirt had gone through just about a month or so earlier with Dadashev, and, you know, hearing him say, like, you know, that's it. And I know that, you know, I think you talked to Buddy as well, but I talked to Buddy after the fight, and, you know, he said that, you know, I'll paraphrase him, but he said that, you know, he was looking for the towel, or his assistant trainer there was going to give him the towel in that eighth round to throw in. I mean, I can't imagine what was going through the mind of Buddy McGirt kind of in those few minutes during and after that round. But Kovalev rallied, and I was impressed, you know, with his performance. I mean, Anthony Yard, I don't we went into it having no idea what Anthony Yard was. He was a guy that was undefeated, but untested as a pro, did not have any kind of rich amateur background. So he was, and to a degree still is, something of an unknown. I guess the question you now have to ask is, like, what percentage is Sergei Kovalev of the guy we saw just kind of running through the division from 2013 to 2016? I mean, how far away, Keith, do you think he is from being that guy?
Chris, he's clearly a diminished version of the guy who was tearing through the division once upon a time, you know, beating some high-level guy. You know, Hopkins was obviously an older guy when they fought, but, you know, some good wins against Jean Pascal stopped him twice, and a lot of people thought that he won the first fight against Andre Ward. You know, he was one of the best fighters in the world at once upon a time, and that guy no longer exists. I think, you know, whereas maybe back then he was an A-level fighter, an elite-level fighter, maybe he's closer to a B-level fighter even on his best day now. He is a good boxer. You know, he's got a great jab, which he really showed. He used that really to not only to knock out Anthony Yard in the 11th round, which is rare, as you know, but he controlled the fight with that punch for the most part. He's a smart boxer, and he's relying more on his boxing ability now than his power, because I don't think he quite has the same snap on his punches that he once did. Certainly doesn't have as much punch resistance as he once did after getting stopped a couple of times. You know, the Ward stoppage was a little controversial. He hit him low a few times, and although I think he was on his way to getting stopped anyway in that fight. But the Elider Alvarez knockout was a clear, been knocked down three times. So that those things have taken a toll on him to some extent. So he's not the same guy anymore. But he's still a pretty good fighter. I wouldn't favor him to beat any of the other light heavyweight champions. You know, Beterbiev, Vostik, or Dmitry Bivol. I don't think he would beat any of those guys. But he's still, you know, he's still a formidable fighter, though. It's not like he's, you know, certainly wouldn't use the word shot. I mean, you can't be a world champion and knock someone out with a jab if you're completely shot by any stretch, you know.
Yeah, he's declining, no question, but he still has good power. He still is a skilled guy. He still continues to have the problem of really having no idea what to do when he gets hurt. I mean, that was the problem to a degree against Andre Ward. It was definitely the problem in the first fight against Alvarez. And in that eighth round, there were moments where I'm kind of looking at what I'm seeing and like, just take a knee, Sergey. Go down, take the 10-8 round and, you know, rally from there rather than wait for a referee to come in and stop it on a flurry from Anthony Yard. He was fortunate that that never came, but that still is going to be one of, I think, Kovalev's Achilles heels, along with the weakness to the body that he clearly has. But he gets the win, and that was important. And now we look forward, we look ahead to Canelo Alvarez, because that is the fight that is on the table for him on November 2nd. And there are some layers to this, right, Keith? It's not just one thing here. The first part of it is Sergey Kovalev, after a tough 11-round fight, ready physically to face one of the best fighters in the world, albeit one that's moving up two weight classes, in Canelo Alvarez? Can he come back in 9 or 10 weeks to take a fight like that? Now, I talked to Buddy McGirt. He said the November 2nd date that DAZN has penciled in is perfect. You, I know, have talked to Kathy Duva. She's not being too resistant. At least I'll let you kind of describe how she characterized it to you. But from reading your stuff, it seems like she's open to November 2nd. How do you think physically Kovalev is going to be for a November 2nd fight?
Well, it isn't ideal, Chris. This time frame is certainly not perfect. I'm not really sure why Buddy McGirt would say that, because it clearly is not. He's a 36-year-old guy who just went through a grueling fight, almost got knocked out in that fight. It would be much better if he had some more time off to recuperate, you know, a couple of months, honestly, and then went into like a real training camp and everything. But the bottom line here is there's a lot of money at stake. It's an 8-figure purse that's being offered for this fight. It's not really something that he can walk away from, certainly not something that he can turn down for the second time in 5 or 6 weeks. He's at a point in his career where he has to look forward to taking care of his family for the rest of his life. He's not going to make this kind of money to fight anyone else. Clearly, you know, there are other interesting fights out there for him. If for some reason this fight was not made, he could fight the winner of the Vostik Beterbiev unification fight on October 18th. He could fight Dmitry Bivol. There are other fights out there for him, and he would make 7 figures for those fights, but not 8 figures. So, you know, he has a young son and a wife to think of moving forward, and his career is clearly in its twilight. So I don't see him turning this down, despite that this is the date that DAZN needs for this fight to happen on. I can't see Kovalev turning this fight down. He'll do an abbreviated training camp. He's all while he's, you know, beaten up and battered to some degree because it was a tough fight. He's already in shape, so he won't have to spend any of training camp really getting in shape, because he's not going to gain a lot of weight in between, you know, August 24th and whenever he begins training camp. So I think he's just going to have to look at it that way and go about it the best he can. But the bottom line is there's just too much money at stake here for him to turn this fight down.
Yeah, I agree. And I would add to that that if they do make this fight happen, they have to go above and beyond on the medical stuff. I mean, we are just a couple of months removed now from, you know, a tragic night in boxing where, or a tragic week in boxing, really, where two people were killed as a result of injuries they suffered in the ring. You can't have Kovalev coming off a fight like that and not be extremely vigilant on the medicals. I'm talking MRI. I'm talking the best doctors in the world. He has to be completely cleared by the right people. You know, if for no other reason, Keith, then it's the right thing to do, but it's also optically the thing you need to do going into a fight with Canelo Alvarez. They need to be sure that he is 100% healthy and physically able to fight.
I completely agree with you on that, Chris. I think, you know, Main Events will do everything in its power to make sure he undergoes a full battery of tests to make sure that he's okay going into this fight. Look, they care about Sergey Kovalev as a person. Of course, this is a business and they're all trying to make money. That's why they're all involved in this ultimately. But they do care about their fighters. I mean, they've always been that type of company. So they will make sure from a moral standpoint that everything is done that they possibly can to make sure that he's okay going into this fight. And I also think that this is a situation where the Nevada State Athletic Commission, the fight is supposed to take place in Las Vegas, so they would have jurisdiction over the fight. And I think they would, if for some reason he wasn't given a full battery of tests, you know, they should make sure that they even go further than Main Event. You know, just have as many tests, dot as many I's and cross as many T's as you possibly can to make sure that he's okay going into this fight, because it was a grueling fight the other day, and he is an older fighter. He's been banged around pretty good here in the last couple of years, so, you know, you better to be safe than sorry in that respect. And there's obviously an inherent danger in this sport anyway, so yeah, but I think they'll play it as cautiously as possible here, and you know, if there's something that they don't like, you know, maybe the fight won't happen.
Yeah, and again, you know, optically be as transparent as possible, like get all that information out about his medicals, make sure everybody knows, because that will be a talking point throughout this. If, you know, if we're really concerned about fighter safety, I mean, should this guy be coming back? I would make sure everybody knows that he's as healthy as he can be going into a fight of that significance. Now, we talk about the physical part of it. There still isn't a deal. As we record this on late afternoon Thursday, to my knowledge, Keith, there has not been an official offer yet from Golden Boy for Canelo to face Kovalev, which strikes me as a little peculiar, because you would think this would not be that difficult a fight to put together. I mean, it was just, what, 3 or 4 weeks ago where they had agreed to terms on the financials. The reason that this fight isn't already on the books is because Kovalev could not get out of the fight against Anthony Yard. He'd already signed. He already committed. I mean, the wheels were already in motion. But the deal between Main Events and Golden Boy, to my knowledge, was all but agreed to. And the people I've talked to on Kovalev's side have effectively said, if they just make us the same offer, we're pretty much good to go. What do you make of the fact that this continues to be drawn out, that we don't have an offer or a deal for Kovalev and Canelo?
Yeah, I think, Chris, I've been told the same things, that they, if they're offered the same amount of money that they were in late July, early August, the fight would be a done deal. It would be by far the most amount of money that Kovalev has made for a professional fight or any fight, and there's no way that they would turn that down. But from their perspective, and I understand it, if that money was available 5 or 6 weeks ago, there shouldn't be any reason why it's not available now. Now, if the fight had gone worse for Kovalev on Saturday, while he was in trouble in the eighth round, he came back from it. It wasn't like he got knocked down a couple of times, or even got knocked down in that eighth round, or he was down on the scorecards and he came back to win by knockout in some dramatic way. He was in complete control of the fight for the most part, except for that eighth round. You know, Yard just wasn't in good enough condition to do what he wanted to do in that fight for the most part. So There's no real reason, I wouldn't think, from Golden Boy's perspective, to say that Kovalev isn't worth as much to us today as he was 5 or 6 weeks ago. I mean, he's, you know, he's still the WBO light heavyweight champion. He ultimately won the fight by knockout. So I don't think there's any reason for him to accept less money for this fight. And Canelo Alvarez wants the fight. So from Golden Boy's perspective, apparently their relationship with Canelo right now is not good, right? So, and he was not pleased that they did not finalize the fight against Derevianchenko a couple of weeks ago, and now Derevianchenko is fighting Golovkin for an IBF title that was stripped from Canelo. So he's already very displeased about all this. If he wants to fight Kovalev, that's the guy he's targeted, that's the guy he wants, then make it happen. And the other thing that I've been led to believe is that he's willing to give up a little bit from his side of it, you know, to throw in a little extra money to make sure that this happens because it's the fight that he wants. He was willing to do that with Derevianchenko as well. So I don't see why it wouldn't happen. The thing that's strange about it, as you mentioned, Chris, is that they don't have a lot of time here. The fight would be 9 weeks from Saturday, and they virtually have no time really to promote the fight and then allow fighters to go in and have training camps. Now, from Kovalev's perspective, he's already kind of in shape, as I alluded to before, so he might not need a full 8 weeks or anything. But Canelo's not, I mean, he might be doing light training or whatever, but he's not in a full training camp now, I don't think. So he's going to need his time to get ready and get prepared. So I don't know what they're waiting for exactly. I mean, they've already squandered a week here, seemingly for no reason. But I would think it would have to get done within the next, you know, week at the absolute latest, and that's even stretching it, I think, before they would have to get the deal done and announce the fight.
Yeah, and look, DAZN is not going to be able to have kind of like a press tour for this fight, I wouldn't think, just because, I mean, Kovalev's over in Russia, and you're already, the clock's already ticking for, you know, everybody to get into camp and get things rolling. But you do want to start rolling out your entire fall schedule, and they've had all these dates starting to fill up. It really picks up the weekend of the 13th. We got, you know, smaller-ish shows with Devin Haney headlining at the Garden, then Ryan Garcia and Jaime Munguia out in California. But then you roll into Golovkin. You hopefully want to get Canelo. You got Ruiz Joshua. I think we are going to see Danny Jacobs return before the end of the year as well. So they want to get this thing nailed down. I don't blame them for wanting to, like, you know, get this thing over with. And it just goes back to the fact that I don't really understand what Golden Boy is doing in all this. Like, how they've kind of handled Canelo over the last 3 months has been borderline bizarre. You know, going from not being able to deliver the Golovkin fight, which was on them for promising and not being able to deliver, to the whole thing with the IBF, where they put in writing that they wanted Demetrius Andrade, even though they really didn't, and they wound up costing Canelo a version of his title, to, you know, the back and forth Canelo's had on social media with them. I mean, this has really been a pretty bad few months for Golden Boy here, and the only way to resolve it is to make a deal quickly. And even that seems to be, you know, not something they're capable of.
It is strange, being that this is the fight that he clearly wants. Whatever you think of him not wanting the Golovkin fight, he doesn't want it, and DAZN doesn't have it in writing that he's obligated to do it. So for the time being, at least, it's not going to happen. But this is the fight that he wants, and he was willing to do the Derevianchenko fight also, which I completely understand. But those fights aren't happening either. So it's been very messy over the last, like, couple of months, obviously. And I think there's some, you know, there's some fracture in their relationship between Canelo and Golden Boy Promotions. I mean, you know, there's attorneys talking to attorneys and all kinds of stuff. So I'm not really sure what to make of it exactly. But the flip side of it is DAZN wants him to fight Golovkin, as we've discussed many times, and he's refusing to do it. So I don't really think you can blame that on Golden Boy Promotions, because I'm sure they would have gladly had him fight Golovkin again, and he, for whatever reason, does not want to do it. So I don't really think that falls on them, but it does fall on them in the sense that they have a responsibility to DAZN to deliver the fights that they want. So that doesn't look good for them either. So it's been a weird time for sure for the relationship between Canelo and Golden Boy Promotions.
That, and making the Kovalev fight would be a decent save, because, you know, even though you and I both agree that Canelo would be a significant favorite in a fight like that, it still is a big name, the most well-known name at 175 pounds, a guy that's made a career fighting on HBO, who's fought some of the best in the world, with Canelo moving up two weight classes to do it. So if they can make that fight happen, I think it still is a pretty marketable one. All right, let's move on to the heavyweight fight in December, which was recently announced, and finally, everyone is on the same page. Anthony Joshua will try to get his titles back in a rematch against Andy Ruiz. This fight's going to take place in Saudi Arabia. A lot of consternation, let's call it, about that. Andy Ruiz balked at first. He was given a little bit more money, a little bit more assurances about security, all those little sweeteners that he got in that contract. So now we have a fight in Saudi Arabia. Let's start there, Keith. What are your thoughts on, you know, Eddie Hearn taking this fight to Saudi Arabia instead of being back in New York or on Joshua's home turf, either in Cardiff or in London?
Well, I think he would have preferred it. The financial ramifications obviously are important, but he offered the fight to Andy Ruiz in London or Cardiff, and Andy Ruiz did not want to go there. So then he said, well, what would you like then? And he said, I want it on neutral territory, because they were not, Eddie Hearn had decided they were not going to come back to the United States for the rematch where the first fight was, obviously. So they said, he said, put it in neutral territory and we're good to go. Well, he put it in neutral territory. It's not ideal neutral territory. You know, it's not exactly a place that I think Americans would like to travel to. Sort of have a heinous history in terms of human rights violations and many other things. But it is neutral territory, and he went and got the best deal that he could to make the most money possible, mostly for Matchroom and for Anthony Joshua. But he didn't do anything wrong in that. I mean, that's what he's a promoter supposed to do. You know, he's supposed to go find the best deal possible. These Saudis are offering a lot of money, and, you know, he could have turned it down, obviously. But then, you know, how do you say I turned down $40+ million to take the fight there? So the other thing that rubs me the wrong way just a little bit as far as it pertains to Andy Ruiz. Look, he signed a contract to fight for what I believe was $9 million in the rematch. You know, he was given the opportunity of a lifetime to fight Anthony Joshua on short notice, and he did everything that he was supposed to do. He made history. You know, it was one of the biggest upsets in boxing history, obviously, and he deserves a lot of credit for that. But he's contractually obligated to give Anthony Joshua an immediate rematch, and he's supposed to be paid $9 million for it. Go fight the guy. You know, you owe him that rematch. And it, all this stuff about, like, I'm not going to fight, I'm going to give up my titles, it just got to, you know, I don't know, it just all rubbed me the wrong way a little bit, because he really wasn't in the driver's seat as he was trying to make it seem like he was, because whether he likes it or not, Anthony Joshua is still the star here. I mean, he beat him up pretty good, knocked him down four times and stopped him in the seventh round. But make no mistake, Anthony Joshua is still the A side of this whole thing and still was in control contractually of the rematch. So if it's in Saudi Arabia, it's obviously not ideal for reporters, and I would prefer it to be somewhere else, of course, but I don't see anything. I don't see the beef that Andy Ruiz would have when he asked for the fight to be in neutral territory, and now it is.
Do you think that he would have, I mean, do you think it would have been a bigger problem for Andy Ruiz to go to Cardiff than Saudi Arabia? I mean, do you think he would have put up an even bigger stink? Because in the aftermath of that fight, I mean, Eddie Hearn told me in the ring, he told everybody outside the ring afterwards that the rematch would be in the UK. And that made sense because Joshua had traveled to the US. Because you have contractual control of everything, it makes sense to want to put it in the most comfortable environment that Anthony Joshua could possibly be in. Do you think that Andy Ruiz would have balked even more at going to London or to Cardiff?
I think what he should have, had he agreed to go to London and Cardiff, it would have been under these circumstances. No British judges and not a referee from the UK either, because obviously the referees have had a tendency to step in maybe a little sooner than other referees might have in some of Joshua's fights. So I understand those concerns. I would have made them guarantee that none of the four officials would have been from the UK. And then just, what's the difference? You got to get in the ring and fight him anyway. What, of course all the people are going to be against him, but you know, most of the people were against him at Madison Square Garden too. The building was filled with,
oh yeah,
Huh?
Oh, I said, oh yeah, no, they were, that was a pro Joshua crowd through and through.
It was almost like fighting in front of, you know, you're fighting in front of a British crowd, except the building was in New York. So what really is, of course, there would have been a larger crowd in Cardiff. You know, if it was in a stadium in London or Cardiff, the crowd would be four times the size that it was at Madison Square, you know, three or four times the size that it was at Madison Square Garden. But I think if he just had the officials neutral, and I would have just gone, I would, if I were him, I would rather go fight Anthony Joshua in London or Cardiff than to go through this, whatever this craziness is going to be in Saudi Arabia. I that's my own personal perspective, but he wanted neutral territory, and that's what he got.
Yeah, but do you think that Joshua is taking too big a risk here? Because, I mean, this is his career, basically. Like, he loses to Andy Ruiz. He is going to have to start a fairly substantial rebuilding process to prove that he's not like David Price 2.0, that he can take punches. It might frankly be unrecoverable if he loses to Andy Ruiz the second time. You would think that all the, those factors being considered, he'd want it on his home turf. He'd want to fight for it to be in the UK. Instead, he seems perfectly okay with having this fight in Saudi Arabia. Is that, I mean, how big a risk do you think Joshua is taking here?
I think maybe the reason that he's okay with it being in Saudi Arabia, Chris, is that he's getting a nice piece of whatever that site fee is, you know? So I'm sure he's making a lot more money for this fight than he made for the first fight. And you know, that I don't think he just wants his opportunity. I think, yeah, of course he would prefer to be in the UK. I mean, that's his home and that's where all his fans are and everything. It's going to be a very, very different atmosphere than he would have had at Wembley Stadium or, you know, Principality Stadium in Cardiff or even Madison Square Garden. But, you know, I think he's, the money is a big part of it. And I think he just wants his chance to go in there and show that June 1st was not who he is. We won't know that until December 7th. And like you said, I mean, he'd have to undergo a serious rebuild if he gets knocked out by Andy Ruiz again. I mean, David Price 2.0 might be a little harsh, but you know, he's had some good wins in his career so far. But I do agree with you, though. I mean, his career, you know, he'd have to rebuild his career for sure if he gets knocked out again. The one thing I would say, Chris, is that, you know, Andy Ruiz seems like a very good guy. Like, you know, and deserves a lot of credit for what he did on June 1st. I just hope that he doesn't kind of lose. He's been doing a lot of things, you know, birthday parties and buying all kinds of expensive cars and jewelry, and it's his money. I'm not here to count it for sure, but I just hope he doesn't lose sight of what's about to happen in 3 months, and he goes and trains the right way and gets ready for this rematch the way that he should. And that he doesn't really, you know, I just hope that he's not the Haseem Rockman of 2019 is, I guess, my point. And the way he's kind of gone about things in the last couple of months, I'm not saying he shouldn't be enjoying himself for the biggest, you know, one of the biggest upsets in boxing history, but I just really hope that he's focused and he really gets in a good training camp and doesn't have any excuses when he gets in the ring with Joshua on December 7th.
Oh, one of the things I think we both agree that Ruiz benefited from was the fact that he went right from that fight against Dimitrenko into training for the Joshua fight. So we didn't have any time to slow down. Now he's had time to slow down. And look, he could be in peak condition come December 7th, there's no doubt. But as all this time passes, and I'm seeing the same things that you are, it reminds me a little bit of some of the problems that Top Rank had with him. And some of the stories that came out of Top Rank towards the end of their time with Andy Ruiz, that it just didn't seem like he took his career as seriously as you needed to. And you needed to keep him busy in order to keep him, you know, kind of in that peak condition and peak mentally for top shelf fights. There's no denying his talent. I mean, he has high level talent. I mean, he's got a great amateur background. His hand speed is good. His foot speed is good. I mean, his conditioning, kind of the way he looks, belies the type of fighter that he is. But he has, you know, a history of not taking things seriously. So I think that's a very real worry if you're on Andy Ruiz's team, that, you know, is he going to be fully there? Is he going to be as invested in the December 7th fight as he was in the fight last June 1st?
That's going to be the interesting thing over the next 3 months, Chris, is make his team making sure that he is that focused, because he has five children, I believe. And, you know, he's spent a lot of the money that maybe all of the money that he made in the first fight. And while he's making a sizable sum of money for the second fight, you know, he's not going to get that kind of payday again if he gets knocked out in this fight. You know, I mean, he'd still be a marketable name, because you can't take away the fact that he did what he did June 1st. I mean, think of how many paydays Haseem Rockman got even after Lennox Lewis knocked him out in their rematch. You know, he was still a name in the heavyweight division. He was able to ride that out for a few years. So I'm not saying there wouldn't be any more paydays at all for Andy Ruiz, but he wouldn't – if he beats Joshua again, think of what kind of position he's in to fight the winner of the Tyson Fury-Deontay Wilder rematch. That's if Deontay Wilder gets past Luis Ortiz. But, I mean, he'd be in great position to make massive amounts of money after this fight. So, you know, you just hope a guy, you know, he's 29 years old, and again, a lot of mouths to feed. So you hope he just doesn't lose focus and lose sight of what's important over the next few months. And then, you know, you can go enjoy yourself again or, you know, when you have some more time off or whatever. But he doesn't seem to have slowed down with the victory tour here. So hopefully he'll do that within the next couple of weeks. I know they have a press tour coming up that's going to Saudi Arabia, London, and New York. So he'll get back into camp there. And, you know, he's never going to be like an Adonis-looking guy, but that's not him because, as you said, he's got a body. You know, his skills defy and his game overall defies his body type. So, and he was actually heavier for the Joshua fight than he was for that previous fight. I guess it was 6 weeks before.
Yeah.
So, you know, you just hope he doesn't get up closer to 300 pounds before he comes in for the rematch.
Yeah, I mean, it's he's going to make some money the rest of his career no matter what, because as you point out, when you've already been a heavyweight champion, and in Ruiz's case, a unified heavyweight champion, you can cash in on that name for a very long time. But, I mean, this is a lottery ticket type of fight for him in terms of a Wilder fight, a Fury fight. Who knows? Maybe, you know, a year from now, 2 years from now, a Joshua fight for the third time. There's just a lot he can do with the win. By the way, you mentioned like the atmosphere in Saudi Arabia. I have no idea what to expect. Like, they're literally building a stadium for this fight. At one point I heard it was like 7,000-8,000. Then it was, you know, 14,000-15,000. But I don't know who's going to be there. I don't know if it's going to be like a UK contingent, if it's all going to be locals. Like, I have no idea, Keith, what to expect from this crowd in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I don't know how you could, Chris. From what I was told, the stadium that they're constructing is, you know, it's obviously expandable because they haven't built it yet. But yeah, they can just, if they keep selling tickets at a rate that is good, they'll keep expanding the seating. I believe it's going to be built on sand. So I don't know. I don't know all the details, but that's the way it was explained to me on the outskirts of this city somewhere. So I don't know, my friend. You send me a postcard and let me know how it's going.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll do that. All right, let's talk about a fight this weekend. A pretty good fight, too, over in the UK. Vasily Lomachenko, unified 135-pound champion, trying to add one more piece of that 135-pound title to his resume when he takes on Luke Campbell. And Luke Campbell's a very interesting fighter. I don't think he's talent-wise on the level of Lomachenko, but he is a former Olympic gold medalist. He is a guy that was life and death with Jorge Linares, and Linares, you know, acquitted himself fairly well against Lomachenko a year or so ago. It looks like Campbell is a fighter, in my eyes, Keith, that is improving, and he will have what looks to be a considerable size advantage over Lomachenko. When we've seen, you know, Lomachenko has only been beaten once, but as we've seen, size can cause him some problems in fights. How do you see this Lomachenko-Campbell matchup playing out?
Obviously a tough fight for Luke Campbell, but like you said, Chris, he's probably the most decorated amateur in British boxing history, and more was expected of him as a pro so far. You know, he's been a pro for 7 years basically now, you know, but basically almost 7 years, and he hasn't won a world title yet, which is really surprising to a lot of British boxing experts because they expected him to be maybe even a multi-division world champion by now. But as you mentioned before, he fought Jorge Linares. I was impressed with him in the Linares fight because he got knocked down. I think it was in the second round and he got cut early in that fight. He had a lot of things going wrong in that fight. And then he was able to steady himself and really come back in that fight and make it a really difficult fight for Linares. And he's, like you said, he's a pretty big guy. He's about 5'9", 5'9 and a half, which is tall for the lightweight division. And he lost a split decision to Linares, who, you know, when he fought Lomachenko, it was a flash knockdown, but he knocked Lomachenko down, and it was a very close fight when Lomachenko snuck in that body shot that ended it in the 10th round. So, you know, based on that common opponent, I mean, you could see the fight being reasonably competitive, but it just seems when guys get into the ring with Lomachenko, they're just bewildered by what he's doing, basically. So He does have his home crowd behind him. It's just the O2 Arena is sold out. I think it'll be 18,000 plus there in the building on Saturday. And this is really Luke Campbell's moment to prove to people that he's capable of doing what they once thought that he was. Now, it's a really tall order, obviously, because Lomachenko's one of the two best pound-for-pound fighters in the world, I think. But this is the if Luke Campbell's ever going to do it, it's Saturday night. I think Lomachenko's about a 16-1 favorite or so, according to most of the internet sports books. So, again, it's a big challenge for Luke Campbell, but this is it for him. And he does have a size advantage over Lomachenko. He's a good technical boxer. I think it'll kind of be a chess match for the most part. I think it'll go the distance. I don't think the fight will end by stoppage. Campbell's two losses have both been split decision losses. So, and obviously Lomachenko has never been knocked out. But Lomachenko has fared well, Chris, against southpaws. He did really well against Gary Russell Jr. and he did well against Rigondeaux. But those guys were much smaller than him. Whereas Luke Campbell obviously has a size advantage, so that'll be the big difference.
Yeah, and look, Lomachenko's so good, but if there's a weight class that he's at least a little vulnerable at, it is 135 because he's such a small 135. I don't think anybody touches him at 126 or 130, but at 135, when he does have to face bigger guys like a Luke Campbell, I think it at least creates the possibility that he can get caught with something, that he can get stopped because he's such an offensive-oriented fighter. I mean, he's there. He's hard to hit, don't get me wrong, but he wants to fight. And sometimes when you engage like that, you wind up getting caught, and that's what happened with Linares, and it could happen with Luke Campbell. But I'm on the same page with you that, you know, Luke Campbell, this is it. Like, this is your moment. You may not have to retire after this fight like Anthony Crolla, you know, may be done, but Luke Campbell, this is where, this is your line in the sand, man. Like, this is it for you when it comes to this fight. Let me ask you, you know, while we're on the subject of championship fights or even unification fights, back down a weight class at the 130, we're still dancing around Gervonta Davis and Tevin Farmer. And I help me make some sense of this, Keith, because Gervonta Davis, you know, he made that offer to the Showtime side made the offer to Tevin Farmer for $2 million. I don't know what they were going to pay Gervonta Davis, but they offered Tevin $2 million. That was a non-starter. From my understanding, Tevin wants three and a half to fight Gervonta Davis. That wasn't going to happen with Showtime side. But, you know, Eddie Hearn's been very public that he made Gervonta Davis a $5 million offer. And I don't know why Gervonta Davis would turn that down. I mean, is it just because they don't want him crossing the street and fighting DAZN? I mean, he could do exactly what Jose Ramirez did. Go across the street, fight on DAZN, beat a guy that I think you'd be favored to beat. You know, although Tevin's a good fighter, I would probably favor Gervonta Davis by a little in that fight, and then take your title, your real title, back across the street to Showtime. What am I missing here? Why is this not a no-brainer fight to make?
Yeah, I would favor Gervonta Davis by a lot, Chris, to be honest with you. But I will say this. I agree with what you're saying about, you know, crossing the street and then coming back with two titles. Eddie Hearn was just saying that last week when he was in town for the Golovkin-Derevianchenko press conference. He was saying, you know, telling us about the offer that he made. And he was kind of joking around, but he said, you know, we should kind of just have an unofficial purse bid. You know, me and Floyd Mayweather go into a room. He has his envelope. I have my envelope. You know, we see who has the bigger bid, and then we go from there. And it's a one-off. You know, you don't have to sign a long-term contract with DAZN. You just come here and fight the one fight. So from a financial perspective, of course, Gervonta Davis hasn't made $5 million for one fight, so it would be his career-high payday there. But I think the biggest thing working against DAZN from making this fight happen on DAZN, or from Farmer, you know, getting it on his platform, or however you want to look at it, is Floyd Mayweather's allegiance to Showtime, because they obviously made a massive amount of money together. You know, the last how many ever fights it was of his career from 2013 on, you know, he made unprecedented amounts of money, and they have this blueprint for him, and they're going to stick to it because they're. I don't think anyone's going to make the kind of money that Floyd Mayweather made ever again in boxing, but they think he's going to make enormous sums of money if they just follow what their blueprint is. And that's, I'm not saying that Tevin Farmer is not the right fight at the right time, because I really do think Gervonta Davis would win that fight convincingly, but they want him to do it the way that they want him to do it. And they've convinced him of that. So he seems to be fine with this blueprint. He's probably going to fight three times this year. He's probably going to get another fight in before the end of the year. So he'll have fought three times. he got his mandatory out of the way so he can kind of fight who he wants next. They talked about making this Gervonta Davis, Tevin Farmer fight a pay-per-view fight. I mean, that's very ambitious. I don't know who's buying that for $75 or whatever, but I don't think that's a great idea. But yeah, the bottom line is, Chris, is you're right. It doesn't make sense financially to walk away from $5 million, but they've satisfied him financially so far and convinced him that the plan that they have for him moving forward will ultimately make him enormous amounts of money. And I guess who's anyone to argue with Floyd Mayweather about that or with Leonard Ellerbe? You know, they were there every step of the way. And I'm not saying that he's as talented as Floyd. Floyd Mayweather was a generational type of fighter. I'm not saying Gervonta Davis is that. But the kid does have a fan base now. I mean, he sold almost 15,000 tickets to his fight in Baltimore. I was actually there that night. It was a huge crowd. A really good – the fight wasn't good, obviously, but it was his mandatory and he had to get it out of the way. But it was a good event, and you know, the fans were, you know, he's a hometown star. There's not, you can count maybe on one hand, maybe you might use a couple fingers on two hands to count the American boxers that could sell those amounts of tickets either in their hometowns or anywhere else. So he's emerging, but you're right, the $5 million part doesn't make sense turning that down.
No, and look, two things to what you said there. I mean, the Floyd Mayweather model is a great business model for a fighter if they can follow it. But you have to take into consideration that Floyd couldn't be Floyd until he proved himself, until he beat Diego Corrales, until he beat Jose Luis Castillo twice, until he beat Genaro Hernandez, and finally, till he beat Oscar De La Hoya. After that, he could do whatever it is that he wanted to do. Gervonta Davis has not done that. He does not have what I would consider a true signature win on his resume. He's got a couple of good wins there, but not a true signature win. I don't know if Tevin Farmer would qualify as that, but it would be the closest thing to it, and he would get paid pretty well for it. The other part of it is, I'm basing this on it's an educational statement, educated statement here. I don't know that Showtime would mind if Gervonta Davis went away for a fight. I don't think so. If Gervonta Davis was going to get paid and see his profile raised and it wouldn't be on their dime, I think if Floyd Mayweather and Leonard Ellerbe went to Showtime with that particular, situation, I don't think they would hold him up. I really don't, Keith. I think they'd be okay with that because if Gervonta came back a bigger star and they didn't have to pay for it, I get a feeling that they'd sign off on that type of deal.
Chris, I would agree with what you're saying. It makes sense if it weren't in the current climate that Showtime is in. It hasn't been a great year for Showtime Championship Boxing. So if they would allow him to walk and fight somewhere else, from a public relations standpoint, that wouldn't be great for Showtime at this point because, you know, there haven't been a lot of really good Showtime Championship Boxing main events this year. The network, obviously, and they would tell you this themselves, has not had nearly as strong a year in 2019 as it had in 2018. And now the Wilder Ortiz fight is going to be on pay per view. There hasn't been a lot on the network itself that has benefited subscribers, so to speak. So I don't know that they could afford to do that now. Ordinarily, if this was last year, and they had the kind of year that they had on the network, I might say yes. But right now, I don't really think that's something that they'd be looking to do. And not that that has anything to do, should have anything to do with whether Gervonta Davis himself wants to do it or not. He wants $5 million, obviously, but I don't think they'd be willing to do that right now, just based on that. You know, and they have a plan to come back stronger toward the end of the year and obviously have a better 2020 because they have to. But I don't think that they would do that right now.
Yeah, I mean, look, if there's a good fight for Gervonta on Showtime, great. Like, I think, you know, Leo Santa Cruz would be ambitious for Gervonta, but, you know, whatever, I'd watch that. I mean, Gary Russell's been practically begging for the fight, which is weird because Gary Russell doesn't beg for any fights. But I would watch that. Just doesn't seem like there's, I mean, is there a natural opponent waiting for him? I mean, you tell me, is there somebody that's really interesting for him to fight before the end of the year?
No, I think, as you said, Chris, the Farmer fight is very interesting because it would be a title unification fight. They've gone out of their way, you know, publicly to build this rivalry up and everything. You know, they had the big thing outside of the MGM National Harbor where they were arguing back and forth for a half an hour or whatever, and they're always going back and forth on social media. I think that's the fight to make. but apparently they're not going to make it. So, and I think if Tevin Farmer were to fight JoJo Diaz, and I know Diaz is taking another fight, I guess, but if he were to fight JoJo Diaz, that's not an easy fight. So, you know, he'd be taking a pretty big risk, I think, by fighting someone as good as Diaz. I'm not saying Farmer couldn't win that fight, but it's not an easy fight. So, you know, so he'd be taking a risk by doing that. But otherwise, yeah, I mean, the fights that would be intriguing for Gervonta Davis other than Farmer are fights that apparently are not going to happen. I mean, everyone would love to see him fight Lomachenko. Yeah, Lomachenko obviously has a blueprint for what he's doing. He, you know, if he beats Luke Campbell, he's supposed to fight the winner of Richard Comey, Teofimo Lopez, assuming he does that. No guarantee that he would beat Lopez, although he would be favored. But just for argument's sake, say he wins those two fights. Bob Arum has said that he's willing to – he might move down. He's not really a big 35-pounder, as you said before, Chris. So he'd be willing to go down and make 130 again. So they – Gervonta Davis, Lomachenko could happen at 130 as opposed to 135, so Davis wouldn't even have to move up in weight. But the one thing I will agree with Bob Arum about is that he said, I think it was today, I'm pretty sure he said this, that, you know, if Floyd Mayweather thought that right now Gervonta Davis would beat Lomachenko, he would make the fight, because that's the fight that, as you mentioned before, Chris, what's his signature fight? Well, obviously that would be it. I mean, Lomachenko is one of the best fighters on earth. And if he were to beat him, I mean, that would change his career for the rest of his career. I mean, that'd be a signature win.
Yeah, no question about that. We'll see how that all plays out, hopefully in a good way before the end of the year. Let me finish, Keith, with the heavyweight scene. We know that Tyson Fury is going to come back September 14th in Las Vegas against Otto Wall. And I do find it amusing that Tyson Fury made this, you know, making this big splash in the U.S. is fighting two European guys in his kind of U.S. tour here with Tom Schwartz and now Otto Wallen. But he's got a fight on the books. We keep talking about Ortiz and Wilder, November probably, but I still don't know if there's a date yet, if there's a venue yet. Do you think, what do you know about that fight in particular? And do you think we're still on track for Fury versus Wilder if Wilder wins sometime early next year?
Yes, I do. I think the Wilder-Ortiz rematch will happen November 23rd, and I believe it will happen in Las Vegas. I don't think that's a good idea, to be honest with you, because of what happened June 1st. Despite Luis Ortiz's age and the fact that he might be older and all that, I still think it's a dangerous fight. I think it's a fight Wilder would be favored to win because he's already knocked him out and he's a devastating puncher. But I don't. It's certainly not an Otto Whalen type of fight, you know. And I don't know. I mean, based on what happened June 1st, it just proved to us yet again that anything could happen in boxing, and certainly could happen in the heavyweight division. So I'm not crazy about Wilder fighting Ortiz first if the goal is to get to Wilder Fury 2. I think if the Wilder Fury 2, I'd say he beats Ortiz November 23rd and Fury beats Whalen on September 14th. I'm not quite sure that February 22nd is going to be the date. It seems like a pretty quick turnaround for Wilder. I know it's technically it's 3 months after, you know, after he would have fought Luis Ortiz, but you have to factor in the holidays and all that kind of stuff. And I don't know. It just seems like it might be a quick turnaround. So I don't know why they're trying to. Also, it's dangerous to marry yourselves to a date when both guys have to win fights before they even get to it. No matter what you think of Otto Whalen, I mean, Fury still has to beat him and Wilder has to win an even tougher fight. So I wouldn't be surprised if that February 22nd date got pushed back a little bit.
What do you think, quickly, what do you think about Otto Whalen here? Undefeated, but untested. You know, he was supposed to fight BJ Flores recently. He's been kind of climbing the rankings very slowly. I know our good friend Jolene Mazzone wanted to put Cassius Chaney in with Otto Whalen at some point. But is he any kind of threat in this fight?
You know, I think he's better from what I've seen, and I've watched him on YouTube because he fought on show. It wasn't a show box; it was like a Showtime Championship Boxing Special Edition or whatever. But the fight only lasted like a minute and a half or whatever because his opponent Nick Kistner got cut down in Atlantic City. So I didn't really get to see much of it. I was covering that fight live. I didn't get to see much of him that night, obviously. But from what I've seen on YouTube and stuff, he's this big southpaw. He can move a little bit. He can punch. But how would you know what to make of him? He hasn't fought anyone anywhere near this level. So again, this is his moment. You know, Luke Campbell is a more proven fighter, obviously, but this is his moment to change his whole life. And the one thing I will say, Chris, he told me an interesting story a couple of weeks ago, and I wrote this story for the website. You know, just in terms of motivation for him, you know, he grew up in a place where boxing was in Sweden, where boxing is banned, was banned for like 35 years or 40 years or something like that. And his father was a huge boxing fan. And his father like was an amateur coach when boxing was legal in Sweden, I guess. And he was just loved boxing, and he loved Ingemar Johansson, and always told him the stories about watching him, you know, pull off one of the biggest upsets in heavyweight history and all that. So and then unfortunately, his father died on May 22nd. He had a heart attack. It was, you know, he died unexpectedly. He was 68 years old. And that's weighing on Otto Waelen a lot, you know, because him and his father used to talk all the time about having a huge fight in Las Vegas, you know, a kid growing up in Sweden in a relatively small town in Sweden and getting an opportunity to fight on the biggest stage and fight for a heavyweight title. And while this technically is not a heavyweight title fight, in effect, it is. And it's going to be, I guess, like about 3.5 months or whatever after his dad's death. And I think he's really using that as motivation. And you know, some people don't believe in that kind of thing, whether that's going to make any kind of difference or whatever. But it's just something to factor into it, that the kid, he's going there, you know, kind of trying to do this for his dad, because his dad was, you know, would have been there with him if he was still alive. And his dad came to his last fight in Atlantic City and spent some time. He lives in New York now and trains in New York. So his dad spent a couple of weeks with him, and so he got to spend some time with him, like literally right a couple of weeks before his dad wound up passing away. But so that's just, you know, beyond making a lot of money and pulling off a huge upset, he's got this motivation going for him also. So it should be an interesting story, because again, he's from Sweden, and that's where Ingemar Johansson's from and everything. So they'll play that up going into the fight. But he's obviously, I think, Tyson Fury is a 25-1 favorite, and understandably so because of their track records.
Keith, always appreciate it, man. Thanks for joining me. Catch up with you next time.
My pleasure, Chris. Thanks, man.